We're looking tonight at Bethlehem, and probably of all the cities that we are going to look at, by far Bethlehem is going to be the least populated, the smallest of those cities. In fact, it probably, by the definition of a city, does not qualify to be a city. It would be a town or a village, perhaps. And the writer of O Little Town of Bethlehem that we just sung a moment ago, that we usually sing as part of our Christmas observances, really, I think, captured the idea. Here's this sleepy little village. It's quiet and really unaware that in its midst this grand and glorious thing was happening in the arrival of God's most precious Son. So it is a place that transects that. But there's a lot of history, both before and after, that we need to know. Let's just take a moment before we even get into the text tonight. And we're just going to divide it into these three sections: historical background, and that's the biblical history, and then the spiritual lessons and life lessons for us, and then we're going to reach a conclusion. But I thought it might be just interesting at the beginning that we talk about Bethlehem now, how it currently exists. It is still in existence, still known as Bethlehem. It's a place that can be visited today. If you want to go ahead and bring up the first slide. One of the key things, if you visited Bethlehem now, is this church that is known as the Church of the Nativity. And long after Christ was born, actually the Church of the Nativity was built in 330 A.D., so now 3 centuries after Christ's birth, by Constantine. He wanted to have a church that commemorated the place where Christ was born. There was a tradition in Constantine's day that there was a cave outside of Bethlehem that became the traditional place that they believed, or many people believe, where Christ was born. There's no way that you could prove that one way or another, but that's what tradition told us. So he built this large church over it, and down in the bottom of the church, in the location of this cave, is this little grotto you see down there. And it's not a very good picture. You can see it online if you wanted to. It looks almost like a fireplace almost. It's kind of back in, and there's this silver star set on this this marble stone slab, and that's supposedly that they will take you now, and this is the place where Christ was born. We don't really get into that, because we know that the place is not the important thing, whether that is or it isn't. There's nothing special about the place. The specialness is what occurred and the results of what God was doing, but that is part of it. Interestingly, back when there was the Palestinian uprising in the early 90s, Bethlehem was a hotbed of that uprising. And the Israeli government went to great efforts to try to put that down and bring things back under the control of their government. And there was a long siege in the Church of the Nativity. Many of the Palestinians who were causing trouble and acts of violence and destruction, they went in and held up in the Church of the Nativity, which gave the Israelis a real problem. We're not going to shell it. We don't want to shoot it up. We don't want to blow it up. So it was a long time. In fact, it was only settled by the Palestinians being released, but they had to leave Israel. They had to agree to go and be, quote unquote, in exile in some other Arab country. So that's how that ended. The other thing that you could see in Bethlehem today is this one. Now, at the top, you see this is an old picture that was taken somewhere in the 20th century, between 1900 and 1910, and it just looks like a little, you know, little dome building with a little attachment on the side. And this was the supposed site of Rachel's tomb. Okay, you remember Rachel, who was notable, that she was the mother of Joseph and Benjamin, two of the 12 tribes of Israel. And, of course, she was the favorite wife, if you want to say it that way, of Jacob, who was later, his name was changed to Israel. So in some sense, she became the kind of the mother of Israel and its tribal identity. Again, we don't know if this is the place where she was buried, but there is this structure there that commemorates where she was buried. And we'll look in the scriptures just a moment and see, indeed, she was buried in Bethlehem, although whether this is the site or not. Because of that uprising that I mentioned to you in the early to mid-90s, if you go there today, it looks like it does at the bottom. And you can just barely see the tip of the dome in that picture. What Israel decided to do, because this is a very extremely sacred site, to the Jews. In fact, it's a place where Jews go there to pray. Interestingly, you remember Rachel. Remember now her sister and Leah and her were both married to Jacob. Leah's having children. She at that point doesn't, and she's very, you know, seeking God's blessing to have a child. And then along comes Joseph, and then later, really, as she's dying, because she dies as a result of childbirth with Benjamin, that son, and we'll look at that in just a moment, she is buried there in Bethlehem. And because of that background, it's a place where many Jewish women go to pray when they're wanting to have a child. It's kind of a destination for that, to ask blessing on your children, or even pregnant women will come and offer prayers there. That's their tradition. But it's so sacred to the Israelis, and because of its position close to the difficulty in Bethlehem, they built a whole fortress around it. It's now like a fortress. It's like with walls all the way around it and armed guards, and you have to go through checkpoints to get inside of it. So rather than looking like it looked 100 years ago or so, it now is this little thing inside of this fortress. Interestingly, if you go from, say, Jerusalem to visit Rachel's tomb, the only way you're allowed to go is by escorted bus with bulletproof glass in it. That's the only way. You have to go in a bulletproof bus to get there, according to the officials in that day. So those are two notable things, and both of them recount biblical history, although certainly we don't know that that's the exact spot where that took place. There's another interesting feature, and I shared this about a year ago when we were looking at some of the hidden treasures, and we did that series. But just outside of Bethlehem, and if you look at the top, it just looks like the top picture just looks like a hill, a little point. But that is an artificial structure that was built by Herod the Great. Basically, he leveled off the tops of two mounds, if you want to say it that way, two hills, took that dirt and rock and rubble and added to the top of a third one and created his own artificial mountain. The top of it, and you can see looking down an aerial shot in the bottom right-hand picture, he created a large fortress there. That basically is what was underground, that if you can imagine from that structure, then a fortress coming up out of the ground. And you can see artist drawings on it if you want to study that later. But this was one of his escape places. If things got too hot for him in Jerusalem, or there was an uprising or rebellion, or the Romans got after him, whatever it was, there were two places he could run to. One was this one, which was known as the Herodium, named after himself. It was interesting that in 2007, after years of archaeological investigation, finally, in 2007, it was confirmed that the Herodium was the place where Herod the Great, and that's the Herod of the Christmas story, where that Herod was buried. They did find his tomb back in 2007 at that location. But he could go there and have this large fortress, and it was well stocked with provisions, and he could hold out there. The other one was Masada. And some of you have heard of Masada in your study of history, but it overlooks the Dead Sea, and it's in a very barren place, but it's this big plateau that just kind of rises up, and it's got the high ground, so to speak, and that was another one of his fortresses. But if you would have been in Bethlehem when Jesus was born, as you looked out over the horizons, just outside of the town, the most notable thing that you would see on the horizon would be this. It's interesting, in the place where Christ was born, at the time Christ was born, the shadow of this king, this non-Jewish king, although he claimed Jewishness, but he was a proselyte, at least that was his claim, but under the shadow of this earthly power, God's greatest power came to be. And it's interesting in that juxtaposition of those two localities. So that's a little bit, just I thought you might find that interesting about where things are today. I want you to, as we get into the historical background from the Bible, I want you to go all the way back to Genesis chapter 35. And we're going to look at a number of places, so we're going to kind of zoom from Genesis well into the New Testament for our study tonight. But in Genesis 35, in verse 16, in this story that we find the first reference in the Bible to this city called Bethlehem, this village, this town called Bethlehem. Genesis chapter 35 and verse 16. And they journeyed from Bethel, and when there was but a little different distance to go to Ephrathah, Rachel labored in childbirth, and she had hard labor. So apparently this wasn't the destination. This was the place they got to en route, and they had to stop because the labor pains were upon her. Now it came to pass when she was in hard labor that the midwife said to her, "Do not fear, you will have this son also." And so it was, as her soul was departing, for she died, that she called his name Ben-Oni, but his father called him Benjamin. So basically that the name she gave him was Son of My Sorrow. That's what that name means. But father renamed him Benjamin, which means son on the right. And by extrapolation, that's usually taken to mean the son of my right hand, a son of some importance, if you want to say it that way. Verse 19, so Rachel died there and was buried on the way to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem, so it had a different name. And Jacob set a pillar on her grave, which is the pillar of Rachel's grave to this day. Now that's as of the day of writing, which would have been about the time of Moses. It's no longer there to this day. And then Israel, or we also know him as Jacob, journeyed and pitched his tent toward the Tower of Eder. Now, just note, because when we get over into the New Testament, we're going to find something very interesting about Rachel once again, okay? And it intersects the Christmas story. But just remember what occurred there. So this village is very, very ancient. It's very, very old. Clear back in the times of these patriarchs, it was a noted place. And then Moses recounts it as he's writing the Genesis accounts that we have even later, years later now, and recording this is the location. There's another place in the Scriptures where this story is important, and that is in the book of Ruth. If you want to just take a moment and go a little bit further to the book of Ruth. And just take a moment here, and I want you just to look at just a few things. We don't have time to tell you all of Ruth's story, but we just want to pick out a few things from her story. Back, you know, Ruth's one of those stories that's almost one of the overlooked books of the Bible. But it's just a lovely story. If you like love stories, it is a beautiful story about how God in His providence brings this woman to the man that ultimately is the love of her life. She is a widow, of course, and her first husband has died. But if you look in the very beginning of the book, in 1:1, it tells us, "Now it came to pass in those days that when the judges ruled," so this story takes place within the confines of the history of the book of Judges, which is the preceding book, "that there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to dwell in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons." Now, we know the story that the two sons get married in the land of Moab and so forth, but because of the famine, the father dies, and it says in verse 4, "Then they took wives of the women of Moab. The name of one was Orpah, and the name of the other Ruth, and they dwelt there about 10 years. Then both Mahlon and Chilion also died, so the women survived their two sons and her husband." So you have these three widows living outside of their country because they were driven out by famine. Let me just summarize quickly what happens. One daughter-in-law decides to go. Ruth is going to go back to her home place, back to Bethlehem. Ruth decides to go with her. The other daughter-in-law, even though Ruth encourages them both to stay among their people, Ruth decides that she is going to go back, and that's in verse 16. "But Ruth said, 'Entreat me not to leave you or to turn back from following after you. For wherever you go, I will go, and wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people,'" and here's the important part, "'your God shall be my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. The Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything but death parts you and me.'" So here Ruth loved Naomi, her mother-in-law, and she had embraced the God of Israel. She was a believer, even though she was not a Jew. She was a believer in the God of Israel, and she goes back to Bethlehem, and then the rest of the story unfolds. By the way, you've probably heard some of those words from that text. Oftentimes, it finds its way into a wedding ceremony, where you dwell, I will dwell, and so forth and so on. Although in its original context, it's not talking about a husband and wife, although those loving words could be applied that way. It's talking about the love between this this daughter-in-law and this mother-in-law and their common bond they have. Not just because, I'm sure they loved each other as people, but the love was bonded them together was their common faith in the one true God of Israel. Now, if you've never read the story of Ruth or it's been a long time, I'm not going to spoil the suspense for you, okay? About who she meets and how it all unfolds and that sort of thing. But suffice it to say, Ruth meets a man that becomes her husband. And Boaz is his name. You can read how that all takes place. And then the end of the book, end of Ruth's story, over in chapter 4, she has a son. Verse 13, chapter 4, it says this. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. And he went in to her. The Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. So Boaz marries Ruth, the daughter-in-law. They have a son. And this is very interesting now. Then the woman said to Naomi, blessed be the Lord. Now this is the grandmother now. Blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day without a close relative. And may his name be famous in Israel. And they go on and they talk about it. In verse 16 it says, Naomi took the child and laid him on her bosom and became a nurse to him. And the women and the neighbor women gave him a name saying, there is a son born to Naomi, and they called his name Obed. Now, how would you like that? We're gonna farm out the naming of a baby to the neighborhood women, and by committee, they get to name the child. That's what happens in this text. And they name him Obed, and then the interesting thing flows from that. Obed, he is the father of Jesse, the father of David. And you know that in that line of David, someone very special is going to come, and that is our Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ. And if you study, and sometimes we wonder, what is all those genealogies about? All those begat somebody, and begat. It takes a little bit of work to pull it all apart, but basically that is a record that God works generationally. And God is bringing things to pass, and several places you see God's grace. In the genealogy of Jesus Christ, here is this woman, Ruth and Boaz's son, Obed, and here this non-Jewish woman, a Gentile, came to faith in God, came into God's family through this circumstances and through these events, and then is privileged to be part of God's program to bring the Messiah to the world. God has always been lavish and inclusive with his grace. And you see that in the genealogies of Christ. Okay? Now, you're going to have to, the next book, since you're in Ruth, it's not going to be much of a stretch, but because it's the next book, 1 Samuel and chapter 16. This is the next place you run into goings on, as it were, in a place called Bethlehem. This is now after the time of the judges. Israel decided that we want a king. Everybody else has a king. They have a king. They have a king. They have a king. Every point of the compass has a king. We need a king. It was not God's best. It was not God's design. But God gives in to their demand for a king, and he gives them Saul, the first king. Saul had a few good qualities, but he had many bad qualities. In essence, he really violated his walk with the Lord any number of ways. He was disobedient multiple times. And finally, God announced that Saul's line would not continue on in this dynasty, in this king line. But God was going to appoint someone else, and that's chapter 16, verse 1. Now the Lord said to Samuel being the prophet, how long will you mourn for Saul, seeing I have rejected him from reigning over Israel? Fill your horn with oil and go, for I am sending you to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have provided myself a king among his sons. So here you have the story of David beginning, who we know Bethlehem was the city of David. It was his place of origin. It was his hometown. And so he goes there, and he greets Jesse and his family, verse 5, and he said peaceably, it's how he's come, peaceably I have come to sacrifice the Lord. Sanctify yourself and come to me to the sacrifice. Then he consecrated Jesse and his sons and invited them to the sacrifice. So we're going to have this worship service, and while he's there, Saul thinks, I'm going to look over this nice lineup of sons of Jesse, and God's going to point out the one that I'm to take this horn of oil and anoint to be king. A little bit of humor in the story. Because he says in the end of verse 6, surely the Lord's anointed is before us. Verse 7, very important verse. But the Lord said to Samuel, do not look at his appearance or at his physical stature, because I have refused him. This is one of David's or Jesse's sons. For the Lord does not see as man sees, for the man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. I could stop there and we could spend the rest of our time looking at that verse, but that's not our purpose tonight. But the very powerful verse that God sees in the inside out. Verse 10 tells us, and Jesse made 7 of his sons pass before Samuel, and Samuel said to Jesse, the Lord has not chosen these. And Samuel said to Jesse, are all the young men here? And he said, well, there remains yet the youngest, and there he is keeping the sheep. How would you like to be poor David? He's just the youngest. He doesn't even get invited to the party. Hey, but the prophet's coming. We're going to have a sacrifice. We're going to have a feast. We're going to have a worship service. The prophet has honored us with his presence. By the way, you just stay out there with the sheep. Maybe we'll have you some leftovers when you get done. But that's about all the respect it gets. And Samuel said to Jesse, end of verse 11, send and bring him, for we will not sit down till he comes here. So he sent and brought him in. Now he was ruddy, with bright eyes, and good looking, and the Lord said, arise, anoint him, for this is the one. And Samuel took the horn of oil, and anointed him in the midst of his brothers, and the Spirit of the Lord came upon David from that day forward. And there you have the appointing, the identification, the home, and the anointing of David. From that point on, Bethlehem, his most notable son, until a bit later, was David, the city of David. Okay, so there's just a little bit of historical background so you have some of that understanding. Now we're going to jump over to the New Testament where we can start drawing some of the spiritual lessons. I'm sorry, before you get, I made a mistake, not quite ready for the New Testament yet. I want you to find a little verse that's found in the book of Micah. Now Micah is very near the end of the Old Testament. Comes right after Jonah, Micah, and Nahum. For some of us, and sometimes this is the easiest way for me, is to go to the last book in the Old Testament and start turning to the front, and you'll kind of bump into these books. Okay? It's another one of those, what we sometimes call the minor prophets because of its smallness. It's a relatively brief book when compared to the length of Jeremiah being many, many chapters, and Isaiah and so forth. Just in 7 chapters, God spins out this prophecy through Micah. But if you look in chapter 5 of Micah, we find this verse, which is repeated over in the New Testament. Verse 2 is the key verse. But you, Bethlehem, Ephrathah, though you are little among the thousands of Judah, yet out of you shall come forth to me the one to be the ruler in Israel. We'll stop there for just a moment. Notice how Micah the prophet, under the inspiration of the Spirit of God, how he describes Bethlehem. He says in the text, you are little among the thousands of Judah. That's sort of like saying, if anyone was trying to find you, you'd just kind of be lost in everybody else, every place else. Bethlehem was not a place you went through or went to. It was just a place that you almost didn't even notice. A bump on the road, so to speak. Just a little point on the map. Tiny. Unimportant by people's standards. But this is the one, as it says, this is the place. And this is what gives the significance to this city. Yet all of you shall come forth to me, the one. I love that designation for Christ, don't you? The one to be the ruler in Israel. So there is this prophecy of the coming Messiah. We're going to talk about the spiritual lessons for right now, the spiritual lessons for Bethlehem, and here is the first one, okay? Smallness does not escape God's notice. It might escape man's notice. It may be overlooked by everybody else, but God who rules sees the absolute smallest thing. And sometimes I think for us, we think, well, it's just little old me and it's just little old us. And what importance do we have? What significance do we have? Why do we matter? Why do I matter? Well, we matter because God takes notice even of the smallest. And you were created by God, and you have been uniquely placed by God, and you have been uniquely gifted by God to fulfill the role He has for you if you're a follower of Christ. There are no small people in God's program. There are no unimportant people in God's program. There are no irrelevant or expendable people in God's program. God knew what He was doing when He scooped together a handful of dust and made Adam. Now that's a different pattern than we got here, but God knew what He was doing when He superintended you to be conceived and to be born and entered this world and to live to this point in life. God knew what He was doing. Get over our insecurity based on it's just little old me. Because we have a big, big God that we serve and indwells us. Now, did you notice I did not read all of verse 2 from chapter 5? Always beware of preachers who do not read total verses. They're up to something, okay? The one to be the ruler in Israel, and this is a key theological verse for us, whose goings forth are from old, from everlasting. David, the king from Bethlehem, the one whose reign continued and God gave special promises to, including the messianic promise, he had a beginning. He was a young man when Samuel showed up and poured oil in his head and said, "You're the one chosen." But he had a definite point in time beginning. So do you and I. So do every other king that's ever ruled. This one, and this is a way to tell and to clue in the readers back in Micah's time, that he's not just prophesying a king is going to be born, like all the other kings that were born. But this one, who is ruler in Israel, who is yet coming, that Micah is prophesying about, is not an earthly ruler in the sense of every other earthly ruler. This is God come to be among men, because He is eternal. He is eternal. Now you and I think you would agree with me that you and I cannot fully conceive of eternity. Everything we know of has boundaries and beginnings and ends. But as we think into the future, we can have some kind of understanding. We know that if God gives us life, tomorrow will follow today. Monday will follow Sunday, if God wills. So we can understand there will always be the next day and the next day and the next day. We can kind of perceive eternity as just the unending process that we've already experienced, okay? But you know what? To think about turning the other way and saying there has been this eternity past where there was no beginning, that causes greater discomfort in our mental faculties than imagining the future being unending. Because everything we've ever experienced has had a beginning. Everything we understand had to begin. There was a date this building was built. There's a date that the Bible you have in your hand was manufactured and printed. We have a date that we were born. There was a date for everything. But God, it says right in the text, this one who was come, whose goings forth are from old, from everlasting. And that's one of the key verses to tell us that God is not only eternal in the future, but God is eternal in the past. God has always existed, uncreated, always being God. And if you can figure that out to your logical mental satisfaction, good luck to you. But we accept it on faith. God is eternal. And I wish I had written down this quote. I'm not going to get it exactly right. I was reading one author this week, and he said this. He said, "I do not want to worship a God that I can figure out. I want to worship a God that is beyond me." Here's one of the beyond me statements you find in Scripture. And this is true of Jesus Christ. And by the way, this is another indication that He was not just a prophet and a teacher and a healer and a miracle worker, but He was and is and always has been and always will be very God of very God, because He's eternal. So, the spiritual lessons, we might think we're so small and so insignificant, but you understand, if you have the mark and the call of God and you have this Savior ruling in your life and your world, and you are a follower of this Christ, there is nothing about your life that is insignificant. It matters. You matter. And we need to make sure that we fulfill the role God has for us. So I hope that helps a little bit. One of the spiritual lessons is the smallest. Secondly, if you want to go over to Luke chapter 2, now we'll get to the New Testament. And here we have the Bethlehem that we know very, very well. The Bethlehem that we encounter in the Christmas story. Now, the prophecy had said, written by Micah, written more than 400 years, this is very important too, more than 400 plus years before the events that we read about in Luke chapter 2. Luke chapter 2. And it came to pass in those days that a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be registered. And sometimes some translations to be taxed. It was this census for the purpose of ruling the government and taxing people. The census first took place when Quirinius was governing Syria. So all went to be registered, everyone to his own city. Joseph also went up from Galilee, out of the city of Nazareth, into Judea. Stop there for just a moment. Now, we understand that Joseph's family connection was through the line of David, if you study the genealogies. We also know that Mary's family, through the genealogies, was back through the line of David. So Bethlehem was their ancestral home. There is a chance, and you can't prove this, but it seems plausible that maybe Joseph and Mary grew up in Bethlehem. One of the things we get from extra biblical history, Herod the Great, that we talked about with the Herodium, and we'll see when we get over into Matthew in just a moment with that part of the arrival story. He had a large construction project going on not far from Nazareth. It required many skilled laborers to carry out this construction project. It's possible that Mary and Joseph grew up in Bethlehem. The only reason they're up in Nazareth is because that's where the work happened to be. Do you have any family members that have ever had to move to go where the work was, where there was a job available? We understand how that works. So they may have been very, very familiar with Bethlehem. And when they came back. But they were not living in Bethlehem, so God has to arrange it just so this coincidence, tongue firmly planted in cheek when I say the word, when this coincidence takes place, that they just happen to be back in Bethlehem when Jesus was born. By the way, the next time the tax man comes calling, I don't know if you got one of these in the mail, I got a thing from the county government saying that the value of my house just went up. And you know what that means, don't you? When the value of your house goes up just because they said it went up, I'm going to pay $400 more in taxes this year. That's what's going to happen. Now, I got to tell you, I wasn't real excited about getting that letter. Now, I know we have to obey the government and higher officials. I will pay my bill. But you know what? God could even use the tax man to do his will. So I guess I shouldn't complain, because God does use the tax man in verse 4. So Joseph went up from Galilee, out of the city of Nazareth, into Judea, to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and lineage of David, to be registered with Mary, his betrothed wife, who was with child. And so it was, while they were there, though that next phrase is not wasted, while they were there, because if this had happened while they were not there, Micah 5:2 would not have taken place. God's word would have been violated. The prophecy would have been broken, and everything would not have been. God would have failed, but God never fails. But while they were there, the days were completed for her to be delivered, and she brought forth her firstborn son, wrapped him in swaddling cloths, and laid him in a manger, because there was no room for them in the inn. And then you have the shepherd story that follows on down. Verse 15, you have another reference to Bethlehem. So it was when the angels had gone away from them into heaven that the shepherds said to one another, "Let us go to Bethlehem and see this thing which has come to pass, which the Lord had made known to us." So you have that part of the story. The greatest blessing for Bethlehem, and this is the second lesson, the greatest blessing that we could ever experience is always tied to Christ. The greatest blessing, the greatest event, the greatest thing that ever happened in Bethlehem, which gave it its significance and has for all these years, it is still a place around Christmas time where thousands and thousands of people gather around the church I just showed you, the Church of the Nativity, and gather around it to worship. Now, I understand we've already talked about the place is not meaningful to us, but nonetheless, when we think of Bethlehem, that's the event that marks it as special. You know what marks you and I as special? What the greatest blessing, the greatest thing, the thing that makes our lives in this little short frame that we live in human history, what makes us significant, it's not smallness, it's the big God, but it's all tied to who Jesus is and his work in your life. Friends, it's really simple, but we need to be reminded again and again and again, our lives are all about serving him. It's all about him. It's all about him. Now, just to be very honest with you, I need to say what I need to say next. And if you want to turn back to Matthew, we want to look at Bethlehem in this part of the story. Matthew chapter 2. Now, this occurs in Bethlehem. It did not occur. We've already talked about this when we preached on the wise men back around Christmas time. It didn't occur the night Jesus was born. It's more than likely some months later, at least. But you have the story of the wise men coming to see Christ. Chapter 2, verse 1, Gospel of Matthew. Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, "Where is he who is born King of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east and have come to worship him." When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. One thing Herod despised among everything else was anybody that would try to take his kingdom from him. And now these guys show up with probably creating a little bit of a stir and a sight as they march into Jerusalem, and they're saying, "We're looking for the newborn King of the Jews," and Herod does not like that. This next verse tells you how seemingly to human eyes Bethlehem, how insignificant Bethlehem was. Because in verse 4 he says, "And when he gathered all the chief priests and scribes of the people together, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born." We got to look this up. Bring somebody in. Herod didn't know. Here he is the quote King of the Jews and doesn't even know this most basic prophecy. And they quote from Micah 5:2, where we were just a moment ago. So they said to him, quote, "In Bethlehem of Judea, for thus it is written by the prophet, 'But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judea, are not the least among the rulers of Judah, for out of you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel.'" And isn't it interesting where they stop? I don't know if they just, that's where they stopped or that's where the line broke, but they stop before this proclamation that this is the one who will rule Israel, whose goings forth have been from old, from everlasting. Then Herod calls them, finds out when the baby was born, sends them on to Bethlehem, says, when you've found him, verse 8, "Go and search carefully for the young child, and when you've found him, bring back word to me that I may come and worship him also." Next few verses tells that they went, they see the star, they find where Christ is, they go in, they present to him these gifts of gold and frankincense and myrrh, verse 13. "Now when they departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream, saying, 'Arise, take the young child and his mother, flee to Egypt, and stay there until I bring you word, for Herod will seek the young child to destroy him.'" So maybe it was under the cover of darkness or through some sort of a quick exit, because they've been warned. Off they go to live in exile until Herod is dead. Verse 16. "Then Herod, when he saw that he was deceived by the wise men, was exceedingly angry. And he sent forth and put to death all the male children who were in Bethlehem in all its districts from 2 years old and under, according to the time which he had determined from the wise men." You know, you think of this great blessing that Christ was born in Bethlehem, but here's the rest of the story. This great tragic act of brutality and self-will inflicted in this little village of Bethlehem. It was a small village. We don't know how many children were slain. But it says in verse 17, there's a connection here. "Then was fulfilled that what was spoken by Jeremiah the prophet, saying..." And this prophecy comes from Jeremiah chapter 31, verse 15. But notice who it references. "A voice was heard in Ramah, lamentation, weeping, and great mourning. Rachel weeping for her children, refusing to be comforted because they are no more. There's a connection all the way back to Genesis 35. As this one who bore this last child of hers, Benjamin, in her sorrow as she died, and she named him Son of My Sorrow. And then Jeremiah picks up this prophecy of this weeping in this place. And then Matthew pulls this verse out and says, this is a fulfillment of that. That there is this great weeping and mourning with the slaying of these innocents. We can also say this. Yeah, the greatest blessing is tied to Christ. But we can also say this. The greatest challenges we're going to face is connected to the hatred of Christ that goes on in this world. Why were these children slain? Because there was a hatred for Christ. And remember this, friends. There is a spiritual war that goes on, and in any war there are casualties. We are told, not in biblical data, but in church history, that Paul was beheaded for the faith, that Peter was crucified. All of the remaining 11 disciples gave their life with the exception of John. He appears to be the only one that lived to old age and died of natural causes, we would say it. And you know what? Someday when we're walking the golden streets of heaven, I think we're going to run into some people there that are part of these casualties that gave their lives because of the hatred of Christ. And we need to honor those that are the fallen in this battle and understand the challenges we face. The world, the devil, and the rulers in high places hate our Savior. Don't be shocked when we're the recipients of some of that sort of venom. Lastly, let's talk about the life lessons from Bethlehem. Just some things to tack into our lives. Number one, it's always too soon to give up on God's promises. Micah 5:2 was stated that Bethlehem would be the birthplace of this coming king, this one who will rule Israel, whose goings forth of old have been from old, from everlasting. Micah never saw it fulfilled. Micah's children never saw it fulfilled. Micah's grandchildren never saw it fulfilled. Micah's great-grandchildren never saw it fulfilled. And if you assume a generation is about 40 years long, and that's a good rule of thumb that we sometimes use in biblical history as a marker, 10 generations after Micah, and of people lived in Bethlehem expecting and wondering and knowing that this prophecy was on the books, and they lived and died, and their children lived and died, and their grandchildren lived and died with this prophecy not being fulfilled until, as Paul states it in the book of Galatians, when the fullness of time, God sent forth His Son. I don't know if you ever get weary in waiting. Lord, when are you gonna set everything right? When are you gonna come back? When are you gonna do for me? Whatever the promise is, it is always too soon to give up on God's promises. And I want to encourage you with that tonight. Maybe there's someone here that's really discouraged. Lord, you just don't seem to be showing up. And when you think about it, some of the promises of God may wait till way after we have come and gone, but that doesn't mean that God's not going to fulfill it, and God's not as faithful to us as He is to every generation, because it will be when His time takes place. I would really like to be alive when Christ comes back for the church. I bet you would too. I mean, if I put it up for a vote, I would mark yes on that one. But you know what? Jesus said it in the text this morning in Acts 1:8 or Acts 1:7. He says, no man knows the times and the seasons. That's God's business. But the promise will be fulfilled, whether it's in my lifetime or your lifetime or our children or our great-grandchildren, whenever it would be, it will be fulfilled. Just trust in God's promises. Secondly, all we really need is Him. What made Bethlehem significant? It was Him. What makes you significant? It's Him. What did Bethlehem need? Him. What do you need? Him. If you got Him, there is the greatest capacity for us to have satisfaction and fulfillment in this life. And here's the great addition to that statement. All we really need is Him, and we have Him. He came. He was born in Bethlehem. His journey began in Bethlehem as far as our understanding, but it didn't end there. It didn't really end in Gethsemane's garden while He prayed. it didn't really end on the cross, although the victory was completed. But it really ended 3 days later when he arose and left an empty tomb behind, completing all that God has. We have him. You might sometimes get discouraged by all the things I don't have. I don't have this, I don't have this, I can't have this, she has that, I don't, he has that, I don't. Don't evaluate your life by what you don't have. Evaluate your life by what you do have. And you have him. You have him. There's a phrase, I'll just pull it out of Scripture and just use it as a conclusion. Trust him who promised. He has given us, as the Scriptures tell us in 1 Peter, exceeding great and precious promises. Let's lean on him. Let's trust in him.